Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you so much for coming out. Didn't hit 100. What are we, just in the 90s? I know. I worried about that, too. There's so many things that can impact an event. But anyway, we're delighted to see you all. And thank you, virtual audience, for joining us. And Megan, thank you for coming.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I always love coming back. So thank you.
So I took her to lunch at the Mission, where she devoured the guacamole.
Devoured. It was
so
amazing.
There's a certain appeal there for, those kinds of things. Also, don't you think Phoenix is just beautiful in April with the Palo Verde come out and those weird white flowers on the cactus that are only there for one day? We have three of them in our yard, and they all came out, in the same morning. It's like a 24-hour bloom. I'll show you a photo of it. Yeah, it'd be great. But anyway, we're here to talk about a book in which water, imagine that. Water is important in terms of a lake. So I even wore a jacket that I thought looked, sort of lakeish. Yes. And you did too, didn't you?
I do. I went with the flowers.
So a question that I would have for Megan when we're talking about daughter of mine is that sort of chicken and the egg question, because all of her books have terrific landscapes that suit the story. I mean, it might be one reason that you read them. So which comes first? Mm-hmm. Do you see a place and that inspires a story, or do you think of a story and then you go hunting for a place?
I feel like it depends on the book, but also often for me, they start hand in hand. Like the idea is very tied to this element of place. And I knew when I had this idea that I wanted to set it around a lake community. And I love the mountains. And coincidentally, I was on my way to a writing retreat in Lake Lore, North Carolina. And if anyone has been there, the geography is going to seem very similar to the fictionalized town of Mirror Lake. But I have this long-running joke with my editor that I either set a book by the water or in the woods in the mountains. And she was like, which is it going to be this time? And I said, it's both. Surprise. But when I went to Lake Lore and I was starting to do some research, I was on a writing retreat and we were in the mountains. So the community is like based around a lake and it's like a bowl where the mountains go all around it. And we were meeting up at an Airbnb and we got there and no one could check in because we had no cell phone service and no Wi-Fi and like nothing. It was dead zone. And as a thriller writer, I was like, well, this is perfect, right? Like you can't call for help. This is the thriller writer's dream. And then I went back in the spring, like when this book was set, to really try to take in the setting at that time of year, what it's like. It also inspired another plot point in the book while I was there. So I do feel like they're so tied together. And especially because the drought is such a character in this story as well, that element of place was one of the first places I started.
Right. So in order to make not all, but at least most of your books work, you need a relatively closed community, don't mm-hmm. you? You can't, it wouldn't work like in Manhattan.
Right.
Right. So you do find these. Remember your Appalachian Trail book,
yep.
which I never can remember titles
anymore. The Last to Vanish.
Thank you. Right. And, there was another one by a lake, mm-hmm. I think, that had a circle of cabins. I hope that's you
yes.
and not another author. Whoops.
I do. Yes. No, I have Such a Quiet Place is also around a lake. And Perfect Stranger had some water. Yes, I've got woods and water everywhere.
And there was your really amazing book that started with an accident at a high school or reunion or whatever it was.
The Only Survivor.
And so you were in the mountains for that mm-hmm. one, right?
Yep. And then it was at the Outer Banks at the reunion.
Right.
Yep.
But you also, because only the people really involved in that original incident could be involved in the later
yes.
one. That's a good. So it's basically Agatha Christie updated to the United States is what it really comes down to, isn't it?
Yeah. No, I think this is why I love setting books in small towns, because I love this idea that you think you know everything about one another, and maybe you've grown up together and you have one perspective of them and everyone else has one perspective of you. And then suddenly as time passes or something happens or a mystery starts emerging or deep secrets of the past, everything can kind of shift and you are re-seeing everyone else in a very different light. And I live in a small town. I love small towns. And this is why I fictionalize it too, because I don't want to take the darkness in someone's beautiful small town. I think both places, like there's pros and cons, like any place can be beautiful and any place can be terrifying. And all these places I start with, I think they're the most beautiful place. And that's why the characters are there. They're kind of idyllic communities. And then when something goes terribly wrong, how are all of those things turning against you instead? And now this, like this lake, you can see it from everywhere as you're driving around the community. But then when evidence starts emerging from below, it's also like you can't escape it. Everywhere you are, you're still seeing the lake kind of as like this black hole, the center of community.
So you're experienced mystery readers, so you know if there's a body of water that's beginning to shrink, that something, something is going to emerge from the water. Peter Robinson and Reg Hill, years ago, both wrote terrific mysteries inspired by the draining of, I don't remember if it was a drought or whether they did it on purpose, but anyway, a valley in England, you know, that had been filled in by a dam and submerged a whole village. And you just knew, you know, you just knew when the water drained away and you looked in the village, there would be at least one skeleton and God knows what. So, you know, lakes are, it's always interesting to me that, and in this case, you do have people doing things on the lake, but they don't go under the lake very deeply anyway.
Yes. And I live near a lake community as well. And, you know, we have like a lot of fun out on the lake. And I was, when I was writing Only Survivors in 2022, I was like procrastinating in the middle of the book and started checking like, what's the news? What's happening around the country at this time? And there was a drought that had descended on Lake Mead. And if you remember the headlines from around there, the first thing that emerged was a barrel, and they found a victim inside that they think had been there since like the 70s or 80s, and nobody was looking for them. Like, they didn't know it existed below the surface. And then a couple weeks later, another body was found as the drought kept, like, the water level kept dropping, but it was unrelated. It was like an accident victim. And I think by the end of the year, there were five bodies that were found. And there was also like an old ship from World War II that had been sunk there. And it just had me thinking of like all these mysteries that exist around us but are hidden under the surface. But what really kicked off this idea was later that same year, I was reading another article. It was about a family who had just bought a home in Northern California. It's a beautiful home. They were doing a big home renovation project. The landscapers dug into their backyard and they found a car buried there. And there was no like license plate. They couldn't really track down the owner. There was nothing inside of it except like a bag of concrete, which seemed a little suspicious. They called the police, but couldn't really see that there was like evidence of a crime here. And that's what really, I think, triggered this idea for me. Like, I'm very interested in that idea. Is there a crime? And if so, what kind of crime? And so, I mean, you can see something emerging from the lake on the cover, so it's not giving anything away. But, you know, as something emerges from the lake, is this evidence of an insurance fraud? Like this car buried in the backyard, is it evidence of an insurance fraud or is it evidence of like something much darker that people are trying to cover up? And that's what really got me going and building this lake community in this closed setting.
You know, as the drought continues, we may find a lot more crimes that we didn't know about as lakes dry up and so forth.
Well, that's kind of what happened.
Because they're convenient for disposal, aren't they?
And like, seriously, I have a group chat with like my editor and my agent, and I sent them these links to be like, are you following this story? And then as I was writing this, we kept seeing them like happening across the country. And I think even this past year, there were like 30 cars found in a Florida lake. Like all of a sudden, the drought was coming across the country and a lot of things are being discovered under the surface everywhere.
I think a nifty variation on that is bodies that are being spit out of glaciers as glaciers are receding. Years ago, Aaron Elkins wrote a book like that set in Alaska where a body was revealed by a receding glacier. And because he was a forensic anthropologist, he was able to determine the profession due to the damage to the skeleton of the bio. I won't go into the whole thing. It was a really cool book. But I think, you know, the world is gradually going to reveal things that have been, you know, set up. So it seems to me in small towns, there's sort of two things. Either everything happens from when you were in high school, or that's how people always know you thereafter, or a stranger comes to town.
Right.
Are there any other variations besides, you know, what happened in high school or somebody new?
Yeah, I mean, I do think in small towns, like the coming and the going is very interesting. And I was just thinking as you were saying that, like, I think it does have to do with both of those things. Like, the backstory of this book is that Hazel is the daughter of this beloved detective in town, and she's drawn back home when she inherits this family home very unexpectedly. But her mother came to town as sort of like the con artist grifter of the community. So it kind of is triggered by someone new coming to town. And also like things that happened back in high school or back in the past. Yeah. Yeah. I just double down on both those things.
Well, it does seem like people in a small town are often defined by high school, either by their friends or if it's a guy, if, you know, he was a basketball star or something, you know, you never really move past that. But also we have in this book, we have a mother who came to town and then a mother who vanished.
Yes.
So another thing for mystery readers to to think about, right? But here's a question. Why is it that the daughter inherited the house? Because she has siblings.
Yes. And actually, I think that's the mystery that sort of kicks off this book. And I always start with character before plot. And so I had this idea for Hazel drawn back to this home because she unexpectedly inherits it. And the reason this causes a lot of friction is because, like I said, her mother was this con artist grifter. And when she was 14, left her behind and left nothing behind but a note that said daughter of mine under her pillow asking for her forgiveness. And you quickly learn that her father is not her biological father and the two brothers are not her biological brothers, but she's the one who inherits this house. And so suddenly I feel like there's moments in any sort of like reality or books, there's traumas and tragedies that can either bond people together or they suddenly show all the fractures that are under the surface. And this just explodes those fractures. Like all the tensions that existed within this family unit are just broken up even more. And that becomes the question, like, why is he leaving this house to Hazel? And her brothers kind of think, or they say, it's because of her profession. So her brothers followed the father into law enforcement, and Hazel left and with her best friends from college started like a home renovation business. Which might have been inspired by the many, many home renovation shows that I watch at home. I was like, this is going to come in useful. I do no home renovating on my own, but I watch a lot of it. So they thought, well, he left you this house because he knows this is your skill and you're going to find the value of it. You're going to fix it up and you're going to sell it and we're all going to split it. But that is not at all what the will says. And so it sort of becomes this question of like, but why? Why is he doing this?
Well, and Hazel doesn't live in this community anymore. No, she's located somewhere else with business partners and all, and she's not necessarily thrilled to have to come back or to have the responsibility of the house. Meantime, the brothers who live there are seriously pissed, you know, that she has the house and they don't. So, okay, great group dynamics there. And I don't know if we can go a whole lot farther without.
I know. It's so hard with thrillers because you're like, okay, the twists start coming very soon after. I mean, I think the things that we can talk about are very much like the setup of the story. And one of the things that I do think sets this book apart from my others, if you've read any of my books, you know they have to do with small towns and how the past impacts the present. This one for me is very grounded in the idea of a family unit. And I structured the book around it. Even before I had the plot, I told my editor, I'm going to structure this book in four parts. And it's going to say part one, father, part two, mother, part three, sons, and part four, daughter. And that became kind of this guideline for me. It moves linearly forward, but you're kind of learning about the different family members as you go. But then as I was writing, it kind of became like when I got to part two, mother, it didn't just become about Hazel's mother and discovering who she was and what the relationship was like. It became about all the mothers in the family. And then when you get to sons, it becomes about all the sons in the family and the different secrets people keep from one another. And so the whole book kind of becomes not just the mystery of what's going on in this community, what's going on with what's discovered in the lake, but like all these relationships within a family as well.
And it's what comes up from the lake is really a big part of this. And you already know that something came up from the lake, right?
Yes.
Right.
Surprise.
You know, I always think that it would be better if authors went on tour like 6 months after the book published, because then we could confidently say, or we could make it a requirement that if you come, you've read the book and therefore we can talk about how it all goes.
Right.
Now, we
all
have occasionally, and this is an interesting thing, with some authors, we have actually done that. We have done a follow-up Zoom where we can talk about the whole book. So, you know, we might do something like that at one point, because then there are questions that you would like to ask after you've read the book that we can't do now, right?
All the spoilers. And we can. Yes.
Right.
Don't worry.
Well, alternatively, we could make it a how many of you belong to the morning discussion club? Did any of you come this morning for that? Or are you a whole new audience? No. All right. Because we do have a discussion club, that mystery club that meets on the third Saturday, which is quite large. So the other thing we could do would be to time this book for them, since none of them are here conveniently, next time.
Yeah.
And then that way they could come in and talk about it.
Yeah.
Right? So there are many roads to doing all that. So Megan's been on tour. And another thing that we discussed at lunch over guacamole is how many books in this sort of general family of mysteries are out in April. Have you all noticed that? March and April?
So many great
Lisa
books.
Unger and Helen Heather Gudenkauf and Mary Kubica and just a whole lot. And, you know, do you think there's any particular reason why that happens, or is it just sort of roulette wheel of publishing?
I do. I think it's just the cycle that we've all kind of found ourselves on of when, you know, I think we, all of our publishing schedules are colliding with our, you know, timelines. But yeah, I don't know if there's, although I do think, and I'm not sure whether it's like chicken or the egg, but like my books are set in the spring and they come out in the spring. And so if we're just seeing a lot of, you know, the seasonal type of books come out right now.
Well, be, yeah. You know, because they do come in clumps. But the great news is that books don't rot on the shelf, right? Mm-hmm. So they're not cheese, they're wine. So you can stock up and then read them when you like. We could talk a little bit about some of your past books. So
sure.
Which one do you regard with great fondness that you'd like to discuss? Because you have quite a lot, big backlist.
I do. I always feel bad picking, but because I always
it's
say,
it's like your
yes,
favorite child.
I know. It's like, depends on the day. I always think like my most recent one is my favorite because I've just lived in their head for like a year and a half. And I really love this main character, Hazel, because she's fearless in a way that I definitely am not. And so I feel like it was fun. Like, I love creepy houses, but I would have been out of this house in a week or a day, and she's, you know, digging into the mysteries. But the ones I found, I kind of correlated this in hindsight, the ones I'm very fond of or that linger with me are the ones I spent the longest amount of time on. And I think it's because I'm in those characters' heads for the longest, or maybe have written so many drafts of it that I know all these other layers to the characters. And that for me, All the Missing Girls, which is my first book for adults, it was one, like my second book idea, my sixth published novel. So it was this idea that I kept coming back to, but couldn't figure out how to tell it the right way. So I'd write 50 pages and it didn't quite work. I'd put it aside and I'd go back to what was under contract because I was only writing young adult at the time. But it was like those characters kept coming back to me, and I was so interested in telling a story backwards as an unwinding of why something happened and stripping away like character motivations. So I still think about those characters. I mean, this book came out in 2016, and I'm like, I hope they're doing okay. So that's one of them. And then The Last House Guest, which was my 10th book, it's always hard to know which books are going to take you the longest when you start, because I thought I had that book nailed in the first draft, as I was writing it. And then when I finished, I kind of realized it hadn't come together. It was two points of view at the time. I turned it in for another set of eyes from my editor, who also agreed something wasn't working. I thought the way to fix this is a third point of view. And I tried a third point of view and that did not work. And then I tried a different third point of view and that did not work. And then I went up to Maine where the book was set. And that kind of broke everything open for me, like visiting the setting again, where you realize, okay, no, it's one character's perspective, and the main heart of this book is like her relationship with time, or with a place that changes over time, and that changed the whole structure of the book. So because of that, it took an extra year and three drafts to come out, and those are other characters that still I think about. Yeah.
You know, you're really amazing, because I can't tell you how many authors I sit here and talk to who have absolutely no memory of the book they finished. And even the book we're here to talk about, which is one reason I'm here, because they're already way ahead into either the next book or the book after. And, you know, they get that deer in the headlights look when somebody asks a question from the audience, you know, they think, oh, shit, I just can't remember. It happens all the time. So good for you that you actually are able to go back and do that. Tell us a bit about, what's the difference between writing for young adults and adults?
Honestly, for me, I don't approach them differently because I write, there's suspense in both age brackets, and I write first person primarily in both age brackets. So I'm putting myself in a main character's point of view and trying to just filter perspective. So that's the main difference for me. And that's usually how I decide whether something is YA or adult, is what is this story best suited for? Like a character who is discovering their place in the world for the first time and, you know, kind of trying to put everything, like an understanding to things they haven't experienced before, which is not to say that doesn't happen in adult fiction as well. But when I write an adult character, I think about filtering the story through their decades of lived experience. And I think that's what is the difference between my young adult and adult books. Like most of my adult books have to do with something that happened in the teen years still. I do think writing young adult is what inspired my adult books, because I would write these books about 17-year-olds, reach the end, they'd get through something really traumatic, and I'd be like, okay, so they're all right now. And then again, you think years later, like, are they? Do they try and leave the past behind? Does the past come back to haunt them? And that's, I think, kind of the core of most of my adult books. And they just have a very different perspective. And in my adult books, I think then you're sort of peeling away someone's perspective of an event that happened in the past and just seeing it from a different lens as they learn new information in the present.
So basically, we never really move away from high school.
Yeah. At least my books don't.
Right. Aren't young adult books are shorter, aren't they, as a general rule, or am I wrong?
Yes, a little bit. Although I have written a young adult book that's about the same length as some of my adult books, but usually maybe 10,000 words shorter, but that's just kind of on average.
So, Danny, if you have questions, we probably exhausted a bunch of what we can talk about. Go ahead.
So which book took the most drafts and how many drafts?
So full complete drafts, The Last House Guest took me the most drafts, and that was 4. All the Missing Girls took me the most partial drafts, because I kept stopping around 50 pages. I wrote the book in the order that it's read, and it moves chronologically backwards. I feel like there's probably a much more efficient way that I could have written this book, but I really wanted to follow the main character and think about why is a narrator choosing to tell a story this way. And I wanted her to therefore narrate it in a way that you're getting to know everyone that way. So because of that, I would get to like the day before and realize what happened the day after and like kind of have to go back and rewrite things again. So it was a constantly evolving draft. I'm not sure how many versions there were, honestly, but I know some of my critique partners have read at least 6 or 7 partials. So that one probably.
So you just said an interesting thing. Tell us about critique partners.
Yeah. So when I started writing, I didn't know anyone in the industry and I didn't have a writing group. And I was very much just writing by myself in my bedroom at night. And when I finished my first book, I thought, well, the worst people can say is no, we'll see what happens. And I sent it to agents and I got a lot of no's. And I had some agents who very helpfully were like, you know, we'd like to see it again when you learn to plot. And so it became like, oh, I have to learn how to have a working plot. And so once I rewrote my first book a few times and signed with my agent, she put me in contact with 2 other writers who we were at the same stage and all starting out in young adult suspense. And we have known each other for, I guess, 13 years now. It's Elle Cozumano, who writes the Finley Donovan books, and Ashley Elston, who did First Sly Wins. And so now we're all writing adult suspense. But it's wonderful to have that community of writers to just bounce ideas off of. And, you know, when you're stuck at a plot point. And I also have a great community. I've met a great community of writers in the Carolinas as well. So that's been really great.
Anybody else? So when you read, what type of book do you read and who do you like to read?
Ooh, great question. So probably surprising no one, I love mysteries and thrillers. That's always what I've been drawn to. My mom was a big mystery reader. I feel like I grew up on mysteries and suspense. I love character-driven suspense. Some of my favorites, Harlan Coben has been a longtime favorite. Tana French is one of my all-time favorites. I have not read her newest, and that's like next on my list. I think she's a beautiful writer, and I love how like she goes into the mysteries of the characters as well. But I also, Mary Kubi, like everyone you just named, pretty much, Riley Sager, Jennifer Hillier, I could go on and on, but character-driven suspense is pretty much what I gravitate towards. I just read Sarah Pekkanen's new book coming out this summer called House of Glass. That was excellent too. So, yes. Yes. So I like so envy that that happened last year, that a phone washed up at my, like a gift from the writing gods. Like, here's your whole plot. A phone washed up and your mind went in a totally different direction. That did not exactly happen in this story, but there are little things that did happen in real life that triggered plot threads. So I'll tell you one. When I went back in May to do research for this book, and I wanted to stay this time not in the mountains, but a house that was very much like where this is set. And it's like right on the lake. So the first level, it looks like a ranch from the front, but it has like a lower level that you then walk down the slope towards the lake. I found an Airbnb that looked like it was the same. I convinced my husband to come on a writing retreat with me. He's always game for a research trip. And we were kayaking, like exploring, like figuring out what's the temperature of the water at this type time of year. And then at night, there was a motion detector flash, like a light outside my bedroom window that kept going off. And if you know anything about me, you know I'm very concerned by this turn of events. I'm concerned about most things that are creepy in the night. And my husband's the complete opposite. So he was like, it's fine. And I was like, it's obviously not fine. And I stared out the window most of the night. And in the morning, we went out front and like the garbage enclosure in the mountains, like the it had been ripped off its hinges and the garbage was strewn all across the driveway. So I was like, I hope that was a bear. I'm thinking it was a bear and I wouldn't go out in the night anymore. And then the next night I did stay at the window because it happened again. And I saw the bear and I was very proud of myself because I was like, I've solved a mystery. And then I put that into the book. So if you read this, there is a point where Hazel is sleeping in her bedroom and a motion detector starts going off outside of her bedroom window. And she does not recall there ever being a motion detector light there. She doesn't know why it's there. And it ended up creating this entire other plot thread. So if you read this, you will see exactly when I was staying at Lake Lore. And that did make it into the book. And I always feel like it's these little things that like, I mean, on one of them, and this is such a little thing, but I always say I don't put anything of real life in the book. Girl from Widow Hills, the start, the main character is talking about her cabin in the woods, and she's talking about how she, like her relationship with her neighbor, and there was a baby bat on her door, and she had to ask her neighbor for help. A few weeks later, I get a call from my neighbor, like, I remember when that happened, and you didn't know what to do about the baby bat on your door. And so it's all these little details that suddenly find their way into fiction.
Yeah. Experience. Yeah. Now, maybe you've seen the Instagram video about, I think they're up in Sholo, but I'm not sure. But anyway, some family that has a cabin in the woods, but it's not so far out, they can't order pizza. So they ordered pizza and, you know, they got the ding that the pizza was there. So they opened the door and there was no sign of the pizza. So then they looked at their ring, whatever the doorbell thing is, and there was a bear that had been waiting for the pizza guy. And as soon as the pizza guy dropped it off, the bear, he didn't hurt the pizza guy. He was there for the pizza. Right. So he, and then, you know, you'd think they would have learned, but it happened again. Wow. I know. I just love it. You know, this is a pizza loving bear. And you have to ask yourself, why? why that is a vegetarian bear or whatever it all is. But, you know, there are really these funny things that happen that I've always thought that would be so funny in a book.
Would.
You know, pizza loving bear from Sholo or wherever it all is. So funny. Anybody else have a question? Yes, ma'am.
What words of wisdom would you give someone that's trying to write and they know they can write, but they don't know what to do with it?
Yeah. That's a great question. And, you know, for me, this is the advice I always give is to really just read broadly and to keep writing, because I feel like leaning into your interest and your perspective is what makes any book unique and kind of stand out in, like, as you were saying, there's a lot of domestic suspense coming out at the same time, but they all, like, you can give anyone, like, a room full of people the same story, but it's your unique take on it that makes it different. Are you talking about the publishing process, though, or the writing process? Yeah. I really think, and, you know, when I started writing, I realized in hindsight that all of my different interests and careers are what really inspired what I was writing. I was a high school science teacher, and I had worked in biotech before that, and my first books were young adult, set in the world of high school, and they were inspired by, like, a weird science question I had that then took, like, a turn towards the paranormal. But you know, I grew up in a family of hikers and very outdoorsy, and that probably is why nature is so important in my book. So I think just bringing in the things you love is going to make it also unique, but also a joy to write. And it's kind of like your area of expertise or your unique point of view.
You can do that. But the other thing is you can write about something you want to learn about.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to write what you know necessarily, but you might want to write what you want to know. And so that can also drive you in that direction. But are you talking about the actual mechanics of writing? Because there are writers' classes, there are online classes and all, where they can teach you about plotting and characterization and all kinds of things.
There's a friend of mine that writes, and it's really good, and I'm like, where do you go from here?
Probably to a writer's conference. Yeah. Writer's conferences often attract agents and editors. They have pitch sessions, for example, where, and you have to pay for the conference, but you don't necessarily have to pay for, often it comes with all of those things. Thriller Fest, which meets at the end of May in New York, they always have something called Pitch Fest, mm-hmm. which means that people, I've done it a couple of times, volunteered as an editor to go, where people come in and make appointments and they bounce ideas off you. And some of them, frankly, are just terrible. but some of them are worthwhile, and some of them you can see that they didn't know what to do with it. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, because just one good idea is not enough to make a book. Maybe a short story, but that's a different skill set also. Short stories are driven by one idea, you know, one plot point. That's all there really is room for in a short story. And sometimes that's easier to learn if you're learning to write, is to write a short story. Have you written any?
I find short stories a really skill hard, that I do not have. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Like, I would have a really, really hard time. I love reading them, and it is not my skill. Yeah.
I know. I'm always amazed by writers like Jeffrey Deaver, who can write 4 short stories a week as well as, you know, 2 thrillers a year. I don't know how he does it.
Yeah.
But I've talked to so many writers who can't write short.
Yeah.
It's like one of those, what's that great letter that somebody wrote to someone? Anyway, he said, I would have written shorter, but I didn't have time.
Yes.
And that's really true. Yeah. It's really true. It's like easier just, yep. It's, I find that, you know, when I'm writing reviews and so forth, I have to really go back and say to myself, you know, do I need this sentence?
Yep.
There's only so much room. How much energy are you going to put into reading a whole book news? You know, what do I do here? So writing short is hard.
It's hard. Yep. I agree.
Anybody else? You had a question back there.
When you're writing your plot twists,
I never know. And I like that. Like, I enjoy being surprised and kind of seeing that first draft as like a discovery. I will say, because of this, my process requires a lot of revision. I think you either do the work up front or you do it later on and you get to the same place. But that's my process. I will say I do use Excel spreadsheets as I'm going. And this either is really boring to people or really interesting, so I apologize in advance. But I love Excel spreadsheets. I don't have like the big murder board with like the strings. But what I do is I see the first half of a book is like discovering puzzle pieces. And I have columns that are like, here are the clues that we found. And I have columns that these are the lingering questions that have come up in each of these sections. And then I'll have a column for like, these are reveals or things that have shifted our perspective. And so it starts to come organically because of that, that you see, okay, something is going to shift at the midway point. Something is going to shift at like the 3/4 point. And I can start plotting them out. But I like going and not knowing because my main character doesn't know. And then I can see everyone as like a cause of suspicion authentically. I will sometimes know a big plot point from the past. So if anyone's read The Only Survivors, the very last twist of the very last, that I knew from the start, like something in the past. I did not know anything about the present. And so the past sometimes helps me create a skeleton of like, these are things we're going to learn, but the actual twists in the present, I discover as I go.
So here's another thought. Authors are very often contracted to turn in a book of a certain number of words. You may not know that, but their contract may say it has to be. Do you have one of those that says?
It might.
It probably, well, yeah, right. Okay, so she does it by instinct. But in point of fact, there generally is today something, because publishers have to think ahead to all kinds of logistical and supply questions. And now COVID was really a nightmare because there wasn't any paper and there wasn't any press time and, you know, what to do. Anyway, generally speaking, there is some expected number of words for a book. Could vary, but generally there is for an author. Yeah. So when you're talking about plot points and all, you have to put them in such a way that they all make it into the book, but they make it in a rhythm that pushes, especially a thriller, can't lose momentum, right? So how do you do that?
I think that's when the Excel spreadsheet really comes in handy, because you're starting to see, like, these are the reveals, and are they happening at, you know, a certain beat in time? But I do think about it as sort of, as I'm writing, and I think because this is my 15th book now, you kind of get a feel like 50 pages. Like, you know, you kind of are like, okay, if something's not happening here, I need to really rethink my setup. And I think that's why I probably spend the longest amount of time on my first 50 pages of the book, because it's setting up all the layers that you kind of see are going to create the different threads going out.
So do you sometimes have to throw stuff away or move it? Because then the beats are not spaced properly?
Well, to me, and I think this is probably what you're saying about a thriller, like it has to move and have the momentum. And it can come from the external plot. It doesn't have to. But if it's not information that's needed in any given time, then I hold it. And that's sort of my rule. Like if this isn't moving the story forward in one way either, through character, through relationship, or through, you know, the setting or the plot, it goes. So I do a lot of pairing back.
It's called Kill Your Darlings.
Yes, there's so many. There's like a graveyard of all of my.
Do you ever save them up and use them in a later book?
I've done that only to a character once. It was from Such a Quiet Place, which is a neighborhood thriller, a lot of houses on that street. And when I turned in the first draft, it was one too many houses on the street. And, you know, they were like, is this character really necessary? And I really liked this character because of, like, his attitude, but he didn't really serve a purpose in a story. He was kind of a jerk, but he had some good lines and he was a source of tension. And so he died a literary death. In draft two. And then when I was writing Only Survivors, also a large cast, I was like, look who's going to reemerge from the ashes. And then I got to explore like his backstory and what made him that way. And it became very different, but it's same personality. Yeah.
So do you save your Excel sheets as, you know, I mean, because writers have very often have, what's the word I want here? Their papers, you know, whatever it is, will go to an institution. And I've talked to a writer recently who's leaving her laptop because that's really where most of her stuff is. Although I'm not sure that's entirely safe,
you know,
because nothing lasts forever, especially if your power goes. But anyway, so in your case, wouldn't the Excel sheets be part of your papers?
I mean, I do. Yes, if there were something that I were to like keep as like this was my process. I mean, I have them. I print them out. They're kept in like the little folder. Yeah, they're very important. And because I also have like, they are color coded. It makes me very happy to see it all organized like that. And then when I'm revising, it becomes so helpful. I'll also have like a word count column for different, you know, what parts of this need to move faster. And so I'll have like version one, version two as you go.
Wow, you could tell she was a science teacher, right? I mean, there's no question here. Many writers are not quite that organized. Now, that's fascinating. You know, process is such an interesting thing. Yes, ma'am. Do you have another one?
Oh, yes. All of the above. I mean, I do work primarily on my computer when I'm drafting. But once I'm deep in a story, the ideas happen all the time. I keep, this is something that I've done for the last few books. I have like a note, the notes app on my phone. I'll have just a running document for like the entire book of like, oh, I have this idea for a good line or like a moment. Or, I mean, I remember even walking my kids to school, and like all the leaves came down in the wind and I wrote a line that ended up in All the Missing Girls from that moment. Like, with a strong gust, they all fall down. And I just wrote that in my phone, came back to it later. And those really helped me also feel like I'm making progress on the story, even though it's not. Like, I don't set myself word count goals because I don't plot up front. And I feel like sometimes progress is realizing the story shouldn't have gone that way. And so I don't want to see, like, deleted words and feel like it's not progress. Like, anything that you discover about your story is progress. So it's fun to go back through my notes app and see like what was in there and what was used and what wasn't, and some things that I write there in the middle of the night and I'm like, I have no idea what that was. Yes.
But if your question is, do you have to be electronic? No. You can do it on yellow pads or you know, sticky notes,
or
absolutely anything.
Yep.
Many writers have sat here and said that the best idea for their book came while they were driving, or, you know, riding a bike or walking or something, and then you can't really pull out your notes app.
Right.
Or you could, but it might not end well.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, they do. I think the ideas come when you're busy doing other things because your mind is, like, freed a little bit. Yeah.
Anybody else have a question? Way in the back.
I'm just north of Charlotte in Davidson, so I've been in the area about 19 years, but I'm originally from New Jersey. Oh, awesome. Okay, well, Muir Lake will seem very familiar to you.
I saw another hand somewhere. Yes.
So how many words are in your book?
About 90,000. Yes. I mean, some are a little bit longer. Some, yeah. I think All the Missing Girls might go up to 95, but yeah, generally.
That's about, yeah, some can be as short as 60. There's a sort of a break point where, what's a novella? A short story is short, usually supposed to be what, like 12? Something along those lines. And then there's a gray area where you could write like a really long short story or a short novella. Those tend to break off around 50 or something like that. And then afterward, we once published a book that became a movie, Drive by James Allison, became a movie with Ryan Gosling, and it was only 40,000 words, so no publisher in New York would touch it because they didn't know what to do with it because of the size. So my husband and I, when we still had Poison Pen Press, which we sold to now Penguin Random House, as it all turns out, in 2019, we took it on because we like Jim, who lives here. We like the story and the whole bit. And Marilyn Stasio did a review in the New York Times, and her review was one sentence. She said, James Salas has written a perfect short book. That was it. That was the whole review. And so in that case, his economy of words, which then became the movie, which they, you know, didn't really have to script much because it was a script, you know, worked out. Yeah. But normally that wouldn't ever make it to publication.
I mean, I do think my first drafts come in much shorter, honestly. Like, my first draft will be 70 to 80. Like, if I can hit 80 and then kind of see the beats as like, okay, if I'm at 40, this is my halfway point. It grows in revision because I'm discovering more layers to the story, I think.
But doesn't it lose some when you cut stuff out?
Yes, it does, but it still grows overall. Yes.
Okay. And then an average thriller probably runs around anywhere from 95 to 120. That's why they, you know, they're bigger because they need more space to like save the world or, you know, chase all over or whatever it happens to be.
Yeah, fantasy gets.
You know, but stories have their own length and it's not like it's an ironclad.
No, takes
ironclad
what it
rule.
Takes.
Yeah. You know, what's interesting is literary forms of poetry. You know, April's poetry month. So we normally have like 5 poetry books in the store because that's not really what people come in here for. But we experimented a little. I'm really fascinated with the variations in structure of modern poetry. It's not all Shakespeare and, you know, iambic pentameter and, you know, sonnet forms. Mm-hmm. Doesn't even rhyme necessarily, you know, it goes all over. And I think, you know, it should be like that. You know, literary forms should adapt, you know, expand, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, I agree. I think a story takes the words that it takes.
Yeah.
So if they're shorter, if they're longer.
Right. Yep. How many of you read, I mean, listen to me, read. How many of you listen to audiobooks? Okay. Nice. So do you find that that you adjust the speed of the narration?
Yes.
My husband is a very slow reader, so he likes to speed up the audiobook. I am such an super fast reader. There is no audiobook that can go fast enough for me. So as a result, I also have appalling handwriting because my hand can't keep up with me. I mean, it was a keyboard that set me free. Up until high school, I couldn't communicate, you know. No, I'm really serious. Yeah. Typing in high school, my freshman year in high school saved my life, you know, because I was never, ever going to be able to write stuff that anybody could actually, including me, read. Yeah. But I wondered about audiobooks. You know, the speed of it, you can expand or contract the listening experience according to what you like, but you can't really do that with a printed book, right? It's it's a different thing, although you can skip parts of it or whatever. Everybody reads differently. Yeah. Right. Anybody have a final question? Right. Yes.
What are you working on next?
Excellent question.
Yes. Yeah. So I'm in the middle of it, like the deep middle of it. So I don't want to say too much because the plot might be totally different when I'm done next year, but I'll tell you what inspired it, which will give you an idea of like the tone. So I have an 18-year-old and a 16-year-old and my daughter. So my daughter and I spent the last year and a half on so many college visits. You know, we like took road trips. We went up and down. We were on like two college tours a day. And at some point I was like, did they see this already at the other school? And then you'd hear a tradition and you're like, that's interesting. And then because I'm a thriller writer, I was like, what traditions aren't they telling us? What don't they want us to know? And I just had this idea of a woman who was dropping off her daughter at the same college she had gone to but left for reasons. And I had this idea and I was telling my daughter on our long drive, I'm like, is this weird that I would like hypothetically write this as I'm sending you off to college? And she's like, it's totally weird. Yes, but you should do it. So that is what I'm working on. Broadly, yes.
So you're expanding what happened in high school to what happened in college?
Right, right, yes. Okay. Moving older now, yes. Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
How long does it take you to write a book?
So it's hard to say for sure because, like I said, sometimes I turn in a draft and it's just not working. But ideally, I usually start in the fall with like, okay, this is the idea. I see the idea for a full book. And it takes me until like June to turn in like what I feel is a strong enough draft to show my editor and agent. So 9 months-ish and then a lot of revising that usually takes me into the beginning of the fall again. So that's why I'm on about a book a year schedule because that's sort of the process of how I write. But sometimes it needs more time.
Yeah, it does. So that's why, you know, you think that she'll turn up like clockwork, but it doesn't always go that way. And that's why we're saying at lunch, if her next book takes longer and she's arriving in the middle of the summer, we're doing a nighttime event. So, and at least everybody, you know, will be able to come. I would like to say about Daughter of Mine that it really is a character-driven book. This is not a book about action nearly as much as it is about the people involved. And, you know, nobody's all one thing. But when you get to the end, it's really interesting how the characters that you met at the beginning are not the people you end up with, which I think, you know, is very human, right? That, you know, in case we all feel like we're just one thing, this is our time to decide that we're not. This is a really tough year, you know, for everybody. And I think it's a good year to get lost in stories and recognize that people can actually grow and improve. Not everybody, apparently not anybody elected to political office, but aside from that, that's my only comment I'm making, but you know, you'd like to think that people do change and grow, even as adults. Yeah. There's still much to learn. And
Yeah. I really appreciate that. And that to me is the joy of writing, like I see a character arc and see who they become. And I love this idea that you're not one thing. Any character can become somebody new.
Yeah, no, I think it's great. Well, thank you very much. Let's give Megan a round of applause.
Thank you.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.